Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty, Washington. Today is Thursday, December 7th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The East African Legislative Assembly raises concern over troops withdrawal from DRC.
You can see that our own partner states have no confidence in our own troops. The Democratic Republic of Congo has lost confidence in our East African standby force and thinks that the solution to their problems can come from outside.
South Sudan says its citizens are fighting on both sides of the Sudan conflict. Mali and Niger agree to cancel tax treaties with France. Kenya's High Court this week suspended the sale of 11 Paris Dottos. We'll get analysis. Several mine workers remain trapped in Zambia since a December 1st landslide flooded an open-pit copper mine.
The latest is that from yesterday to today, five people have been retrieved. Three dead and two alive. So the search continues.
And the Chinese embassy in Nairobi looks to boost cultural ties with Kenyans by launching food extravaganzas. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa.
This Friday, the 8th.
The East African Legislative Assembly has expressed concern over the withdrawal of regional forces from DRC. This comes on the eve of the deadline for the East African Community Regional Force to withdraw after Kinshasa declined to extend its mission.
This Friday, the 8th, is the deadline for the East African Community to withdraw its troops from DRC, which was deployed almost 1 year ago. The East African Legislative Assembly lawmakers have criticized the move, saying it will have a negative impact on the unity of the community. George Odong is a regional lawmaker from Uganda.
You can see that our own partner states have no confidence in our own troops. Can the Council of Ministers tell us why the Democratic Republic of Congo has lost confidence in our East African standby force and thinks that the solution to their problems can come from outside? And yet, our integration, you know very well, is predicated upon collective security.
The DRC's refusal to renew the mandate of the East African Community Regional Forces comes as Kinshasa announced that they failed to fulfill their mission, which was to fight the M23 rebel group that had captured parts of the eastern DRC. Kennedy Mukulia, a regional lawmaker from South Sudan, says that the community is far from achieving its ultimate goal, which is the establishment of a political federation.
Our partner states spent money to send our troops to the Democratic Republic of Congo. These troops, as we speak now, are withdrawing because their mandate has not been renewed, and by one of our partner states. And we are talking about political confederation. Where are we going?
Sources in East African Community confirm that on Wednesday, the regional chiefs of defense forces were meeting in Arusha over a possible withdrawal plan of the troops from DRC. The DRC accuses Rwanda of supporting the M23 rebel group that has caused instability in the eastern part of the country. But Rwandan lawmaker Fatuma Ndangiza says it is not the M23, but the presence of largely Hutu FDLR rebels that is the root cause of the instability in DRC.
For the FDLR, the people committed genocide who are still in the DRC and are responsible for the ongoing conflict that is going on, including ethnic cleansing that is happening in that country, targeting people who speak in Rwanda. And these are matters of concern to East Africans.
The government of DRC has declined to comment on the withdrawal of the East African Community troops, but had earlier signed an agreement with the Southern African Development Community to deploy its troops to fight the M23 rebels. As the country is campaigning ahead of the presidential elections this month, the East African Community Regional Force announced on Sunday that it started leaving the DRC with the departure of Kenyan contingent. The DRC as a new member state of the East African Community. Analysts say that Kinshasa's integration into the regional body has been put to test by the ongoing insecurity in its eastern provinces. For Daybreak Africa, I'm Moses Havyarimana in Kigali.
Several mine workers remain trapped underground in Zambia after a December 1st landslide flooded an open-pit copper mine. At least 38 illegal miners have been trapped in the mine, according to Reuters. Zambian President Hakainde Hichilema visited the site on Wednesday and assured family members that the government is doing everything to rescue their loved ones. Information Minister Cornelius Mwitwa tells me five people were rescued on Wednesday, three of them dead and two alive. He said rescuers were working frantically to reach the others.
The latest is that from yesterday to today, five people have been retrieved, three dead and two alive. So the search continues. The rescue team is working frantically to ensure that these people are rescued in whatever state they are. And true to the president's encouragement that people are still alive, we have been able to see two being rescued alive. And our hope is that more of them are alive down there and they should be able to be rescued.
Who owns the mine, first of all?
The mine is an artisanal mine where people are mining in an informal sector manner. They are mining without proper regulation, without proper routine protocols to be followed. It is some kind of artisanal mining, mainly by the young people, wherein they make a livelihood, and they've been mining for a very long time. It's a tragedy that it happened this time round when it had to rain, when they did not anticipate. Otherwise, once it is rain season, they stop mining. But this time, as fate would have it, they are caught up in this fate. But this is something that has been happening, and it anchors their economy in the informal sector.
Do we know how many people might be trapped under there?
Well, the people who are trapped, it's just an estimation between 30 and 40 or thereabout, because as you would imagine that this is informal mining, there are no proper entries of who goes down to have their details and get to know the numbers. It is just, you know, the way they organize themselves. So there are no proper records of how many people. But according to hearsay, they should be between 30, 40 thereabout.
Are these mines regulated by the government or what?
They are not regulated by government. These are mines which essentially are in a situation where, if you like, the government really leaves people to do this kind of mining, sort of scavenging mining, and the government is not in a position to stop them because they still make ends meet out of there to scavenge, you know, minerals and be able to supply to off-takers, and they make a living that way.
What is the hope that the remaining miners can be rescued?
Well, with the speed that has since been attained, that within 24 hours, five people have been able to be recovered, it is anticipated that going into tomorrow morning and thereafter, more people will be recovered. The most part of the work that was quite inhibitive has already been dealt with, namely to remove the debris, which was about 8 meters high, on top of the entry of the tunnel, which included some mud splash, a combination of rock, soil, and water, which had gushed into the tunnel. So that has since been dealt with. So the rescue team are now pursuing to follow through those tunnels, which are unconventional, like not conventional mining. But the local miners and who know where they've been going are helping the rescuers to follow through. And this is work in progress, and we remain hopeful.
Cornelius Mwitwa is Zambia's information minister. He was speaking with us from the capital, Lusaka. The United States on Wednesday formally determined that warring parties in Sudan committed war crimes. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said as Washington increased pressure on the army and paramilitary rapid support forces, also known as RSF, to end fighting that has caused a humanitarian crisis. Washington also determined that the RSF and allied militias committed crimes against humanity and ethnic cleansing, Blinken said in a statement. The fighting, which broke out in mid-April, has displaced more than 6.5 million inside and outside South Sudan. It killed more than 10,000 and decimated the economy. South Sudan's interior minister says she has been informed the Sudan and Sudanese fighting on both sides of Sudan's ongoing conflict. Angelina Tain says the participation of South Sudanese nationals in the war could have serious security implications for South Sudan. For VOA News, Charlton Doki reports from Juba.
At a recent forum in Juba, Interior Minister Angelina Tain said a strange development was taking place in the conflict in Sudan.
A lot of South Sudanese are also involved and engaging in the war in Sudan on both sides as mercenaries. This has been actually officially reported.
Tain said the government thinks the involvement of South Sudanese in the conflict will have negative implications for South Sudan's security in the long run.
We are very concerned that, you know, they are getting access to these arms. You never know where these arms are going to end up or what they could be used for. So it's a concern for us.
The Sudan Armed Forces and the paramilitary rapid support forces have been fighting across the country since April. Thousands have been killed in the fighting. The United Nations has estimated about 5 million people have been displaced by the war, with nearly 1 million of them fleeing to other countries. Abraham Kuol Nyon is a professor of political science at the University of Juba. He says the involvement of South Sudanese in the Sudan conflict makes it difficult for President Salva Kiir's government to convince the warring parties that South Sudan is neutral.
Remember, some few months ago, when this conflict of Sudan began, South Sudan was proposed to be one of the mediators, especially President Kiir. And the involvement of South Sudanese in the conflict will complicate the impartiality of the South Sudan to act as a mediator.
Professor Nguyen says, having confirmed that there are South Sudanese citizens involved on both sides of the conflict, the Juba government should have distanced itself from their activities to maintain its cordial relations with Sudan.
It is only if the government of South Sudan declare their position very openly that whatever which is happening in Sudan and whoever is involved in the war of Sudan is not on behalf of the government of South Sudan. And that is the only way now the neutrality of the government of South Sudan will not be in question.
Information about South Sudanese participating in the conflict surfaced about 3 weeks ago when pictures of some of the South Sudanese fighters were posted on social media. Some regional observers and security experts say Sudan's warring parties are recruiting foreign nationals to strengthen their fighting capacities. For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Juba.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, December 7th. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. The military governments in Niger and Mali have agreed to cancel tax treaties with France. VOA's French to Africa reporter Abdul Razak in Niamey tells me that the two countries say the agreements are one-sided and have led to substantial loss of revenue for Mali and Niger.
Mali and the Niger governments justify their decision to do away with the tax treaties with France by two arguments. The first one is the persistent hostile attitude of France against their state, they said. And the second one is the imbalanced nature of these treaties, causing a considerable shortfall for Mali and Niger. So normally, according to this denunciation act, the treaties will end within 3 months.
How important are these taxes to the ordinary Nigerian? Or do you think this is a continuation of the dispute between these two countries and France, particularly since the coup in Niger?
Through these treaties, which have been just denounced, Malian or Nigerian citizens, for example, who have income in French banks or who have real estate asset in France will have to pay taxes to both France and their countries. The same applies to a French citizen who have properties or taxable income in Niger or in Mali. And for sure, this denunciation is the latest act of unraveling the links maintained by Mali and Niger with France since the military coups in Bamako in 2020 and in Niger this year. The authorities of another Sahelian country, as you know, whose military took charge in 2022, Burkina Faso, had already denounced the tax conventions with France a few months ago.
What can you tell us, Abdou, about the new confederation that Burkina Faso, Mali, and Niger say they want to form?
This is the main recommendation resulting from the meeting of the foreign ministers of these countries held in Bamako in Mali on November 13. You know that the three countries created the Alliance of Sahel State last September with the main of pooling their efforts in matters of security and defense. During the meeting that I mentioned above, it was also decided to extend the scope of the alliance actions to the political, economic, and diplomatic fields. Finally, you also know that these three countries are no longer part of the G5 Sahel organizations.
VOA's French to Africa reporter Abdul Razak was speaking with us from the Niger capital, Niamey. The Kenyan High Court this week suspended the sale of 11 Paris turtles after opposition petition. Raila Odinga, Orange Democratic Movement, the ODM party, argues that the sale should be subjected to a referendum because of the strategic importance of state firms that have combined assets worth a staggering $1.3 billion. The opposition says the state-owned companies slated for sale can only be privatized with the consent of the people through a referendum. Political analyst David Monda tells viewers Douglas Umpunga that the court's decision is timely.
I think it's a good thing. I think there were a lot of questions raised, and not only about the process involved in identifying the parastatals to be sold. There's the other element of the transparency in the whole process. And there's also a broader question about some of the parastatals and buildings that are going to be sold off, like the Kenyatta International Convention Center, that some of those are national symbols. So I think these are all issues that have to be litigated. Plus, you have to remember that there's this question of public participation. There's an argument that that was not effectively done. So I think those are issues they will have to fix in the courts, and then we see where that goes forward.
Do you find it ironic that the Ruto's government is doing what was done in the past years under the structural adjustment programs that sold most parastatals in African countries?
I'm actually not very surprised, because if you look at Kenya's budget, the government is really out of money. They don't have the money to fund their recurrent expenditures. The government has been lately raising taxes extensively. The government has raised VAT, the value-added taxes. The government has raised taxes on fuel. So you can really see that the government doesn't have money. And I think one of the ways the government is seeing to raise funds is through selling of these parastatals to get a lot of revenue. But to your question, this alludes back to the 90s, to the structural adjustment programs. The government's been borrowing extensively from the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. And one of the conditionalities they have is privatization. The issue with the sale of the parastatals, then we will see, very much like the structural adjustment programs, is the sale of these parastatals actually in Kenya's best national interests, number one. Number two, who is buying these key state assets, some of which are considered strategic assets to the country? But then thirdly is the broader question of the transparency in which these proposed sales are being done.
The Kenyan government has lost successive cases in court recently. Is the government trying to overreach, or is just the judiciary exercising its rightful role as an independent arbiter?
I think it's both. Governments tend to overreach. So governments tend to work right at the edge of the perimeters of their constitutional powers. But then on the other hand, we now see the judiciary as a check on the executive or the governmental powers, executive powers, the judiciary pushing back. And I think this is a good process in terms of the broader questions of judicial oversight, the independence of the different arms of government, and also going forward issues of judicial administration in terms of how will the courts see that cases or laws or government procedures are actually constitutional, but they also follow the law and the statutes and acts that have been passed in parliament.
That was David Mulder, a professor of political science at City University of New York. He spoke with viewers Douglas Mpuga from New York City. As a debate over loans and trade relations with China heats up in Kenya, the Chinese embassy in Nairobi is looking to boost cultural ties with Kenyans by launching food extravaganza. Victoria Amuga has more from Nairobi.
At a hotel in Nairobi, Kenya's capital, dozens of people gather to watch this display of Chinese culture. This performance ushers in a food festival sponsored by the Chinese embassy and hosted by Kenya's China Teachers Association. President of SYNC International Education, Michelle Chang, says their goal is to promote Chinese culture and keep the relationship between Kenya and China strong.
This year, 2023, is the 60th anniversary of Kenya and China diplomatic relationships set up. So I think we should keep in touch more and more and closer and to become like good diplomatic relations within both countries.
Forging stronger ties through cultural events can also bridge language differences, says economist Eric Musau.
European countries generally have always had very strong ties, looking at the Commonwealth or America. The common language is always a big positive between Kenya and most of Europe as well as America. And so for the Chinese, there's that gap, especially around the language barrier. They've been trying to encourage more Kenyans to study the language.
Chinese presence in Kenya has been growing over the years. Chinese companies have built massive projects in Kenya, like the standard gauge railway between Nairobi and Mombasa. At the same time, Kenya's central bank says the trade deficit between Nairobi and Beijing grew to $3.62 billion in 2022, up from $3.51 billion the previous year. Musau says the infrastructure is beneficial for Kenya, but the trade disparity is a challenge for diplomatic relations.
In terms of exports to their market, you're looking at just a couple of $100 million. So the balance of trade is really in their favor. And when you look at the structure of the economies and where, for example, Kenya wants to go, it's very unlikely that you'll ever have a very good overlap in terms of a balance of trade compared to, let's say, America, where exports and imports are almost on balance.
Balance is something that Steve Wakoli says he was missing in his life before he learned the Chinese language and martial arts like Kung Fu. He now makes his living teaching Chinese and performing martial arts.
I started receiving invitations from companies for performances. I went to schools like Chinese Confucius schools. I went to Kenyatta University, went to Nairobi universities for performance.
But Wakoli is an exception. Many Kenyans are uneasy by what they say is too much Chinese engagement in Kenya, especially in the retail sector. Because of the infrastructure projects, Kenya's debt to China stood at $6.3 billion as of March 2023, almost 2/3 of the country's total bilateral external debt. Analysts say cultural programs such as this food festival aims to ease uncertainty caused by what some Kenyans see as unbalanced economic relationship. Victoria Amunga, VOA News, Nairobi.
And that's it for this Thursday, December 7th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for being our guest this morning. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Bolton, Washington, saying have a great day and please be safe whatever you do.